Yeah. Okay. Well, when discussing the possibility of building a mass socialist party in Australia, there can be a tendency to think about it narrowly in terms of the class struggle here in this country. That is, to look at the balance of forces between classes and the relative strength of political parties just here in Australia. Now, the model for this kind of development is, of course, the Russian Bolsheviks. Because while it's true that Bolshevism emerged in a broader international context, and that was very important, there is a real sense in which the Bolshevism developed out of the particular Russian situation. The reality, though, is that this experience was the exception, not the norm. All of the other communist parties built in this period were built as the impact of the Russian Revolution swept the globe, tearing up old certainties, old alignments, and old political organisations. The particular history and alignment of forces in each country didn't matter, but it was the international situation that was the driving force. And I think because of this, partly at least, the possibility of building mass socialist organisations on a genuinely revolutionary basis opened up at the same time that revolutionary struggles erupted that put the possibility of revolution and socialism on the immediate agenda. And so in some places you had the situation where communist parties weren't formed until after the crest of the revolutionary wave had passed. Or in others, newly born parties found themselves at the head of mass movements that they were ill-equipped to lead. So one of the key lessons out of this is just the need for more parties like the Bolsheviks to be formed before the revolutionary struggles begin and reach their height. But I think we have to be realistic on this. If we are fortunate, next time our side might be better placed than was the workers' movement and the socialist movement in 1918. Perhaps we will have two or maybe three parties that are clearly revolutionary and of some size before the outbreak of decisive battles. But really, you can't count even on that. And so I think it's for that reason that it is important and worthwhile looking at the experience of the Comintern's attempt to build communist parties from the ground up in a very short space of time and to try and gain some insights that might make this task easier in the future. Now, in doing this, I don't want to give a sort of Cook's tour of European communism. Instead, I want to concentrate on one example, that of Italy, which I think is useful in illustrating questions that in one shape or another affected and impacted on all the early communist parties. Although, of course, in the discussion, if people want to raise the myriad other examples, they should feel free to do so. But part of the reason that I want to talk about Italy is, and the reason too, is simply the magnitude of the struggles that broke out there. The northern industrial city of Turin, which is the home of the giant Fiat plant that employed something in the order of 40,000 workers by 1918, was known as the Red Capital of Italy. And the February Revolution in 1917 in Russia had more impact there and more quickly, more impact than at any other city in Europe. As news filtered through of what the Russians had done, the idea of doing the same as in Russia was taken up everywhere. By May of 1917, socialist speakers were asking workers to come to meetings in future with revolvers and stressed that it is imperative not to waste time but to work actively for a general insurrection and to get hold of bombs. In August, a bread shortage did indeed lead to an insurrection and doubtlessly there were bombs involved. The insurrection was bloodily put down, but it was out of this uprising that Antonio Gramsci, who was to become the great historic figure of Italian Marxism, first became directly involved in the Turin leadership of the Italian Socialist Party, the PSI. Now, the first Congress of the Communist International was not held until some 18 months after this uprising in March of 1919. And by then, the Italian Socialist Party had grown into a huge organisation, something in the order of 100,000 members. And although it didn't have delegates at the first Congress of the Comintern, it did declare its allegiance to the Comintern straight away, and it was indeed the first mass socialist party to do so. And the fact that they did this reflects a very different situation in Italy than the situation that prevailed in most countries, where the mass socialist parties of the Second International had backed the war and thereafter moved decisively over to the side of the capitalist class. The PSI, the Italian group, had opposed the war since the start. It stood proclaimed for the dictatorship of the proletariat and argued for the superiority of Soviet rule along the lines of Russia over a bourgeois or capitalist democracy. There were three main groups in the PSI. The right wing was the reformist current led by Turati, and it was concentrated amongst the parliamentarians and also among the leaders of the Socialist Trade Union, the CGL. The grouping known in the party as the Maximalists, led by Cerati, were the official leadership of the party, and they controlled the main newspaper, Avanti, and as well as that controlled the central party apparatus. The other main faction that had a national following was led by the Naples-born Bordiga, and this group was known as the Abstentionists on the basis or on account of its opposition to participation in any parliamentary elections under capitalism. Okay, so you have here a party with a self-proclaimed revolutionary leadership that saw itself as being aligned with the Bolshevik government in Russia. There's a minority further to the left of the party leadership, and you know, a few harmless reformists who pretty much went along with most of what the maximalist leadership had to say anyway. So surely, you know, if nothing else, the Italian situation was not one in which it was necessary to build mass parties from scratch, the topic of the heading that's been given to this discussion. But in fact, what I want to argue, and I think what the history proves, is that actually it was as necessary to build mass parties from scratch, a mass party from scratch in Italy, as it was in any other country. For all of their revolutionary rhetoric, the maximalists had no orientation to trying to actually organise the working class into a force that could launch a revolutionary challenge against the capitalist state. And this weakness was to become painfully apparent in the revolutionary upheavals which followed the war. Okay. The post-war period in Italy became known as the Biennio Rosso, or the Two Red Years. In 1919, a huge movement began amongst the workers of Turin to set up factory councils that could impose some element of workers' control over production. And by October of 1919, 50,000 workers across 30 plants were organised into councils, and this number rose to 150,000 workers by the end of that year. The champion of this council's movement was the publication, and I apologise for my Italian, L'Ordine Nuovo, which was put out by Gramsci and some others.
Gramsci.
All right, I'm not going to be able to do that. although it had a circulation of only 5,000 at its height, this publication had an enormous impact. Gramsci saw the councils as being the embryo of organisations whereby workers could start to assert their power over society as a class along the lines of the Russian Soviets. And because of this, they saw their central task as promoting the development and the extension of these councils and explaining to the workers the potential that the councils had as an instrument of the socialist revolution. And because of this, the publication was able to become the ideological motor, as it was described, of the movement, the practical and the theoretical guide for the militants leading the struggle in Turin. Okay, thanks, Liz. In April of 1920, in Turin, 500,000 workers joined a general strike, which was actually provoked by the employers who were trying to end what they rightly saw as a situation of dual power in the factories. And it was a bitter battle. 50,000 troops were moved into the city, and armoured cars took over the streets. In the working class neighbourhoods, which were considered by the government to be particularly militant, guns were trained on bridges, on crossroads, on the factory gates, and even on individual workers' houses. The Socialist Party, though, led by Sarardi, stood by and did nothing in the face of this movement. And worse than that, Avanti refused to print the manifesto which was published by the Turin section of the party. The leadership even moved the National Council meeting, which had been scheduled, from Turin to Milan in order to try and avoid the unrest. And Gramsci sarcastically wondered why the scene of a workers' uprising was such an inappropriate venue to hold a socialist conference. He wrote, "The Socialist Party watches the course of events like a spectator. It never has an opinion of its own to express. It never launches slogans that can be adopted by the masses, lay down a general line, and unify or concentrate revolutionary activity." And the refusal to give solidarity to the Turin workers and to spread the strike nationally really, I think, was the first major condemnation of the Socialist Party as, you know, incapable of acting as a revolutionary force. And as well as that, it also ensured that the workers of Turin went down to quite bitter defeat. And this was a key moment in the whole struggle. If there had been a really revolutionary communist party, the outcome could have been very different. But as in so many countries in these years, the process of ideological clarification ran beside or behind the actual struggle. Just before the strike broke out, Gramsci had written a paper called "For a Renewal of the Socialist Party." And in this he wrote, "The existence of a cohesive and strongly disciplined Communist Party, which centralises within its own executive committees all of the proletariat's revolutionary activity, is the fundamental and indispensable condition for attempting any Soviet experiment." So, you know, quite a succinct move towards seeing the need for a much more clearly Communist Party. But even then, it wasn't still clear whether Gramsci was arguing for a new party or simply, as the title of his paper suggests, a refurbishment of the old. In May of 1920, though, just after the strike's defeat, he participated in a meeting called by Bodiga of the different left groups in the PSI. And in that meeting, Gramsci polemicised against Bodiga's abstentionists, arguing that no political party can be constituted on such a restrictive basis. And a whole series of polemics, most of which Gramsci was right about, but the problem was that his stress was on the communists' winning influence within the PSI, which meant that he resisted the idea of setting up an independent communist party until quite late. Okay, so 2 months after the April movement, the Second Congress of the Communist International began. And unlike the first Congress, this one was attended by representatives of mass forces, of parties that commanded the support of most militant workers across Europe. And there were two main themes of the conference. The first, and the most prominent, was the famous 21 conditions that people might have heard of. And Zinoviev, in his usual sort of hyperbolic manner, described it like this. He said, "Just as it is not easy for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, so it will not be easy for the adherents of the centre to pass through the 21 conditions. They are put forward to make clear to the workers in the USPD and the Italian and French socialist parties what the International General Staff of the Proletarian Revolution demands of them." There you go. Amongst the most important of these conditions was that the affiliates to the Comintern split with the reformists. And this was designed to test those in the centre, the leaders who were willing to talk revolution but who still wanted to maintain relations with the reformists in their own countries. And this tactic had some success in a number of countries. In Germany, the USPD, the Independent Socialists, a left-wing split off from the mainstream Social Democratic Party during the war, commanded by then the loyalty of the decisive section of militants amongst the German workers. And after the Second Congress of the Comintern, its left wing, the left wing of the USPD, won a majority to affiliate to the Comintern. And after that, the right-wing minority split off and the majority fused with the young German Communist Party, which gave the new United Party in Germany some 350,000 members. The Czechoslovakian Social Democratic Party split, with the left taking a majority of the membership into the newly formed Communist Party, which, when it was combined with the Communist Party of the German-speaking minority in Czechoslovakia, was somewhere in the order of 170,000 strong. So it could work. And the Italian party accepted the 21 conditions as a general principle. Even Tarardi, who was the leader of the reformists, claimed adherence to the conditions. But he did so with an agile use of language, to say the least, which people who've seen Yes Minister or dealt with the Young Labour left will probably recognise. Here's what he said. Tarardi called for interpretive unity in the application of the 21 conditions according to the conditions of each country. So he had no intention of expelling himself at all. But much more serious than this was the attitude of the maximalist leader, Tarardi. He genuinely wanted to be a part of the revolutionary movement, but he could not bring himself to break with the reformists, who he insisted were not as bad as those in some other countries where the reformists had openly backed World War I. Tarardi's wasn't the cynical and manipulative, I don't think, but the genuine sort of anguished and paralysed version of centrism. But the other fight that took place at the Second Congress was against the ultra-lefts. And in this, Lenin's devastating pamphlet, Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, was really the main weapon. And the central target of all this was the German ultra-lefts. But the Italian Bordiga also came in for a harsh attack for his abstentionism and opposition to participation in elections. Now, as it happened, Bordiga actually backed down on the question of whether the party should participate in elections. And this hurdle overcome, it could seem that his politics were not too bad. Because actually, Bordiga, more than anybody else, was determined and intransigent in his aim to set up a genuinely revolutionary communist party. But unfortunately, the divergence between the two main leftist currents in the Italian party, headed by Bordiga and by Gramsci, were in reality much more profound than they could initially seem. And to understand this, we need to go back to the question of the factory councils. Because in theory, support for Soviet rule was a matter of common agreement between Gramsci and Bordiga, as well as the maximalist leader, Tarardi. But it was when you scratched the surface you started to see the differences. Gramsci argued that the councils should be organisations of the whole of the working class, not just the most politically conscious members of the trade unions or of the Socialist Party. And further, he saw the factory councils as being the embryo of organisations through which the working class could rule, as I said before. And this is important because nobody else in the Socialist Party agreed with Gramsci on this point. Tarardi spoke for the whole of the left, pretty much, when he argued in reply to this idea that the councils could be the basis for a new form of working class rule. Tarardi argued that the dictatorship of the proletariat is the conscious dictatorship of the Socialist Party. And Bordiga agreed with Tarardi on this. He further attacked the councils as being purely economic, arguing that as long as the capitalist class held power, the only, in quote, representative organ embodying the general revolutionary interests of the proletariat could be a communist party. So both Bordiga and Tarardi had a view of socialist transformation that was based on the party itself playing the decisive role. Both of them dismissed the mass struggles that weren't pre-organised by it. They didn't understand that the party has to lead the revolution, not make it. That the revolution is made by the mass of workers, not by the party itself. And this flowed through. Bordiga's dismissal of the importance of mass struggle meant he was unconcerned about winning over the massive members of the party who followed the maximalist centre. Instead of aspiring to break them from reformism, he wanted to break the pure revolutionary elements of the party from what he saw as the compromised whole. But despite this quite profound disagreement between Gramsci and Bordiga, the logic of events pushed Gramsci into Bordiga's camp more and more. So as Gramsci came to see the importance of a communist party, so he subordinated himself to Bordiga's faction, even though his conception of a revolutionary party was totally different. Okay. The factory occupations, which were really the next mass struggle, an important struggle, began as delegates were returning from the second Congress of the Comintern that I've been discussing. Workers occupied the Alfa Romeo plant and 280 others in Milan. The movement quickly spread across the industrial cities of Italy. Production continued, but now under the supervision of factory councils, of workers themselves. A new revolutionary situation had rapidly developed. The factory occupations posed the whole question of state power, of which class it was going to be that controlled both production and also society. So serious was the situation, in fact, that the leadership of the trade unions, in what was really a classic calling of the bluff, offered to hand leadership over to the Socialist Party heads if they were prepared to lead an insurrection and organise an insurrection. The problem, of course, was that the Socialist Party leaders, though they didn't like to admit it, wanted to do... organising an insurrection was pretty much the last thing that they wanted to do. So instead, they insisted on a referendum of the entire trade union membership on the question. And this idea of a referendum was not some democratic gesture. It was instead a colossal failure of revolutionary leadership. The PSI only called for the vote in the hope that it would lose, falling over itself to explain how willing it would be to accept a vote against insurrection, and who really would vote to put a revolution in the hands of leaders as spineless as that. This led to a defeat, which was decisive, not just in Italy, but really across the whole of Europe. It marked the end of the post-war working-class offensive and the beginning of capitalist restabilisation. In Russia, the failure of the Italian Revolution was an important factor leading to the adoption of what was known as the New Economic Policy, a retreat based on the reality that the Russian working class could no longer expect to be saved by European revolution in the short term. The Italian bourgeoisie, unsurprisingly, wasn't satisfied with this, though. It began unleashing fascist gangs against the socialist and Catholic peasant associations, against socialist papers and municipal authorities. And big capital began pouring money into the coffers of the fascist Mussolini. So this obviously had a profound impact on the left in the Socialist Party. And the left approached the next major event, the National Party Conference at Livorno, determined to force a split. And its main fire was directed at the centrists. One member of the left later wrote, "The Livorno split was essentially and predominantly an act of struggle against centrism. We fought root and branch against Turati, the reformist, but as for Turati, we hated him. The main obstacle was not the reformist, but maximalist centrism." The manifesto of the communist faction, which was signed by Bordiga, Gramsci and others, was almost purely Bordigist. The entire approach that Gramsci had outlined during the factory councils period was absent. There was no reference to Soviet democracy, to organisation of the working class in the factories, to councils, to the relationship between the revolutionary masses and the party. The emphasis instead was on discipline, centralism and purity of Marxist principles. Gramsci deferred totally to Bordiga, believing by that stage that a party on Bordiga's terms was the only basis on which one could be born. Acrimony between the left and the maximalist centre was deepened by the really quite forceful intervention of the Comintern executive, which was really strongly for a split at pretty much any cost. They wrote appeal after appeal to the Socialist Party, to the Italian proletariat, you know, denouncing the centrists, arguing, prefiguring George Bush. One of their manifestos said, you know, if you don't support the Communist Party, the Communist faction, sorry, in this struggle, well, our attitude is, if you are not with us, you're against us. And this really set the tone for the conference. The first left speaker, who went by the name of Tranquilli, was anything but. He demanded that the communist delegates burn the effigy of unity. After him spoke Kabachev, who was a Bulgarian and one of the reps of the Comintern at the conference, who viciously attacked the leadership of the maximalist leadership of the party. And this caused such an uproar that the only way that order was able to be maintained by the conference organising body was that they repeatedly played the Internationale at full volume, which shut everybody up because all the different factions were keen to display their loyalty to the Communist International. So that's something to remember if you're ever organising a conference. But what happened? Well, Bodiga introduced the motion from the left for unconditional acceptance of the 21 conditions. And the vote was 59,000 for with the left, 98,000 against. And on a separate motion, 15,000 voted with the reformists, which gives some indication, all those things together, of the balance of forces. So the communist left lost the vote. And afterwards, pretty much immediately marched out singing the Internationale and held their own founding congress in a neighbouring hall. Okay, so what to make of all this? Well, there's no doubt that a split in the PSI was necessary. But the way in which it happened was an absolute disaster. The majority of militant workers were left outside the new Communist Party, and Gramsci was later to call this fact, without a doubt, reaction's greatest triumph. And that's saying something in Italy. The Socialist Party had over 200,000 members just before the conference. Scarcely 100,000 extended their membership into either one of the new parties. Sarardi did eventually expel the reformists in 1922, which indicates that another outcome was, in fact, or had been possible. But by then, the divisions were so entrenched that even the intervention of the Comintern couldn't secure a fusion between the Socialist Party and the Communists. And to make matters worse, it wasn't just that the most workers were outside the party. To make things worse, the party was led by Bodiga, whose tone had dominated the whole intervention of the left in the Congress. And essentially, Bodiga's politics were no better than that of Sarardi. And afterwards, the sectarian approach adopted by Bodiga, the leader of the Communist Party, really made any united front work that could have won over broader layers of workers impossible. And it wasn't just in Italy that this ultra-leftism led to disaster. It was only 2 months after the Livorno Conference that the catastrophic march action took place in Germany. The new German Communist Party, its confidence boosted by its swelling numbers, attempted to launch an insurrectionary strike movement despite the fact that the massive workers were far from ready for such a move. And the right wing bloodily repressed the uprising. Thousands were imprisoned, and something in the order of 150,000 workers left the party virtually overnight. So, by the time the third Congress of the Comintern came around in the middle of that year, 1921, Lenin and Trotsky had realised clearly that the leftist jag of the Comintern parties was leading to disaster everywhere. And they waged a determined fight to have the policies of the United Front adopted by the Congress. They argued the Communist parties had to orient to winning over the mass of workers that were under the sway of the various reformist organisations. And this meant proposing joint activity with the leaders of these parties. The Italian Communist Party resisted any implementation of the United Front. The most they were willing to accept was what they called the united front from below that bypassed the leaders of the reformist parties. And this really is no united front at all. Instead, it was really an ultimatum call for the workers to rally behind the banners of, you know, directly behind the banners of the Communist Party. And if this was possible, well, there wouldn't have been a need for a united front in the first place. Gramsci didn't agree with this line of the Italian communists, but because he saw the main danger in the party as coming from the right, he kept quiet. The Italian communists aligned themselves at this Congress with the new German leadership that had launched the March Action and which stood by it still. The communists resisted the arguments of the Comintern that they should fuse with the Socialist Party, who Lenin believed, and rightly, that the Socialist Party was about to expel the reformists from its ranks. And I think it's important to note here that Bordiga opposed fusion with the Socialists even if the reformists were expelled, which was the supposedly the source of the earlier dispute. But again, Gramsci didn't fight him on this. He did eventually launch a fight against Bordiga, and he managed to win the leadership of the party away from him by 1924. But by then, it was really too late. The fascist regime, which had marched to power in 1922, was entrenched. And there had been a spirited, semi-spontaneous working-class resistance to Mussolini, but again, the sectarian, abstentionist line of the communists had prevented them from taking a lead in that struggle and taking it further. The real moment of revolutionary opportunity, though, had been earlier, in April and then in September of 1920. And the lack of a genuinely revolutionary party then was really decisive. But even so, a lot could have been done in the later period. Unlike in many countries, there was someone in Gramsci who actually had, in large part, the right idea about what kind of party was needed. But I suppose Gramsci was weakened, I think, by two factors. And the first was the political problem, that he initially had a one-sided appreciation of the lessons of the Russian Revolution and Lenin. He grasped the importance of the Soviets, but not of the party, of the role of a party that could lead a fight for Soviet rule. But then when he corrected this mistake, the tragedy was that he overcorrected. Gramsci was prepared to leave aside an orientation to the factory councils and to the mass of workers in order to realise a new party of any kind, as long as it was revolutionary. And I think that's what explains his repeated capitulations to Bordiga. And the second factor is that Gramsci had no national organisation of his supporters, and this made him much more reliant on Bordiga to win the fight with the right in the Socialist Party. And Bordiga was fanatical about organising his forces on a national basis. Okay, so I'll finish just with some general lessons to be drawn from all this. The first one is that in revolutionary periods, parties can sound much more radical than they actually are. Revolutionaries, though, need to fight for a party with a leadership that is revolutionary in deed as well as in words. Rhetoric is very much not enough. Second, those with a clear conception of what is needed have to be cohered organisationally and politically in advance. It's not enough to learn from the struggle as it unfolds. Realising what needs to be done after a decisive battle is too late. The third point is that an international party can play a vital role, but it's no substitute for building an independent revolutionary leadership in each country. For one thing, the international party can't just jump over or manoeuvre around the local forces when they might be wrong. And secondly, as I think you can see in the split in the PSI, there's no guarantee the international party is going to be right either. The fourth point is that the party question itself is not the only question in revolutionary politics. And I think it's easy to get from talks on failed revolutions that only the idea that some kind of amorphous revolutionary party was missing, and if it had existed, everything would have been fine. Actually, what is needed is a party that is not just revolutionary, but actually then capable of leading a revolutionary struggle, which means being right on a whole series of other questions as well. In this case, you know, the role of the mass struggle, the United Front, and so on. So, as I said at the start, we're going to have to face these questions again if in different forms. There's no way around the fact that, as with the Italians and many others in the period we've discussed, we're going to be running to catch up with events. You know, there's no doubting the fact that revolutions, as well as providing opportunities, present huge dangers and risks at every turn as well. But although the Comintern failed in its goal of world revolution, and humanity has paid a terrible price for that failure, it also has left us, the Comintern, a powerful legacy. People like Gramsci, who in the end sacrificed his life to the cause, did not die in vain. I think the experience of the early Comintern parties and all the things that flow from it actually will be a very powerful weapon for our side next time world revolution is on the political agenda. I'll leave it there.